Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, the killing of a Tunisia opposition figure ignites unrest.
It is a worrying turn of events, but it fits within a worsening stability situation in Tunisia.
Syrian rebel forces step up attacks on Damascus. President Obama is headed to the Middle East. And Bulgaria accuses Hezbollah in a 2012 airport attack. It's all ahead. Thousands of people took to Tunisia's streets today to protest the shooting death of a leading opposition figure amid fears that radicals are threatening to derail the country's democratic transition. Lisa Bryant has details from Paris.
News reports say protesters jammed the main Habib Bourguiba Boulevard in downtown Tunis on Wednesday, yelling shame, shame as they denounced the killing of leftist politician Shoukry Belaid. Other demonstrations are being staged in towns around Tunisia in scenes reminiscent of the country's largely peaceful revolution 2 years ago. One of the leaders of the opposition Popular Front, Belaid, was shot dead outside his Tunis home just hours before. His killing has sparked shock and outrage and fears that religious extremists are trying to hijack Tunisia's transition to democracy.
Nous avons beaucoup d'ennemis de cette révolution pacifique.
Speaking before the European Parliament in Strasbourg, France, Tunisian President Moncef Marzouki said his country has many enemies who want the revolution to fail. He denounced the odious assassination of Belaid, whom he described as a long-term friend. He said Tunisia would reject the message sent by what he called enemies of the revolution. An array of politicians have similarly denounced Belaid's death, including members of the ruling Islamist al-Nahda party. The party chief, Rached Ghannouchi, condemned the murder, saying the killers wanted a bloodbath in Tunisia. But some critics, including members of Belaid's family, are openly accusing al-Nahda of being responsible for his death. Belaid himself had strongly accused al-Nahda of failing to rein in extremist members and of threatening the opposition. Those accusations were echoed Wednesday by one of Belaid's friends, Mokhtar Jalali. Interviewed by Radio France International, Jalali said his assassination was part of a larger plot by radicals to cause disorder. He accused the government of inertia. Considered the birthplace of the larger Arab Spring uprising, Tunisia has managed to avoid the widespread bloodshed that has coursed through other revolts such as Libya and Syria. But the North African country is grappling with rising violence, political clashes, and high unemployment, among other problems. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
We spoke about the assassination in Tunisia with Philip Walker, a regional editor with the Economist Intelligence Unit in London.
It is a worrying turn of events, but it fits within a worsening stability situation in Tunisia that we have seen in recent months, where we have a government struggling to find compromise between hardline Islamists and secular sections of Tunisian society.
Where do you see this going from here?
I expect political violence and unrest to continue at least until elections, which are due in June of this year, but possibly beyond, depending on the results of the elections.
How do you think the transition to democracy has been handled in Tunisia? Could you describe that situation for us?
Yes, I mean, it's a very tricky transition. There's a lot of conflicting desires between of the Tunisian people of where they want Tunisia to go. The revolution has allowed this freedom of expression, and there's so many divergent views. It's squaring those into a political compromise that leaves as many people happy as possible. But obviously, that is proving to be a tremendously difficult challenge.
Sometimes you just can't please everyone.
Exactly.
Tunisia is considered the birthplace of the larger Arab Spring uprising. Does the unrest and unhappiness in Tunisia, does this reflect on the other Arab Spring nations?
Yes, I mean, almost all of the nations that were affected by this transition are going through similar pains during their own transitions. In many ways, in Tunisia has been not as badly affected as some of the other countries, as if you look at Egypt, for example. But yes, this is the expression that the revolutions have allowed to spill out has brought with it, you know, tremendous friction between opposition groups.
Do you have any feelings about the success of the Arab Spring revolts? Is it going to be a failure in the end?
I don't think it's going to be a failure in the end. You know, we see political transitions around the globe involve very unfortunate incidents and frictions. A lot of pent-up pressure has suddenly kind of been released. But I think in the longer term, the people in these nations being able to express themselves in a democratic environment is can only be beneficial.
Philip Walker, a regional editor with the Economist Intelligence Unit, speaking with us from London. Syrian rebel forces stepped up their attacks on parts of the capital, Damascus, today, in some of the heaviest fighting inside the city in months. Government forces responded with heavy shelling of inner districts of the capital and closed off the city's main Abbasid Square. Edward Uranian reports from our bureau in Cairo.
Amateur video shows what Syrian rebel fighters claim to be an attack on a government position in the Damascus district of Jubar. Opposition activists say that the attack is part of a multi-pronged rebel attack on government forces near the capital's southern ring road. Witnesses inside Damascus say that government forces have been shelling to try and repel the rebel attack. Sources inside the capital also say that the city's historic Abbasid Square was closed as fighting raged nearby. The rebel Free Syrian Army issued a declaration calling Wednesday's assault Operation Epic in the capital of the Umayyads to liberate Damascus. The statement listed 6 rebel brigades that were participating in the battle, including the al-Qaeda-linked Jabhat al-Nusra. Earlier, a government security compound was hit in the central city of Palmyra, where a pair of suicide car bombs exploded. Activists said the bombings targeted a military intelligence compound, killing at least 12 Syrian security personnel. State media described the explosions differently, saying they went off in a residential area and killed several people. Peter Harling of the International Crisis Group says that the rebel attack in Damascus may be an attempt to relieve pressure on the rebel-held suburb of Deraya, which has been under heavy government shelling and aerial bombardment for days. He said despite reports that government forces have pulled back from certain areas of the capital under rebel pressure, it was unlikely that the government was about to collapse.
The regime has rebuilt itself into a rather cohesive fighting force, and I think this notion that it's losing ground is partly an illusion. I mean, the regime has been losing ground consistently on the economic, political, moral levels, but I think militarily it's still extremely strong.
Harling adds that the government has massive human resources and military assets in the capital, and that its forces are entrenched in a large and very defensible area in the heights of Damascus. A recent call for a negotiated solution to the conflict by opposition leader Muaz al-Khatib has hit resistance from various opposition groups. The opposition Syrian National Council indicated that it would meet soon to discuss the proposition. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The World Health Organization reports the health situation in Syria has progressively worsened over the last 6 months. And a WHO representative in Syria says there has been a marked deterioration in the ability to provide health care to the civilian population over the past month. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization representative in Syria, Elizabeth Huff, says it is difficult to provide health care to people on the move. Speaking to journalists in Geneva by telephone from Damascus, Huff says Agra, a town outside Damascus, has been hosting some 200,000 displaced people, but many of them are now on the move again because of heavy fighting and bombardment in the town. Huff says this constant displacement nationwide makes it difficult, if not impossible, possible to carry out vaccination campaigns and other health programs. She estimates about 50% of the hospitals in Syria are damaged, and one-third are out of service. She says most of the ambulances are damaged, and those that are functional are being used for military purposes. Hoff says medicines and medical equipment are in short supply.
What I would also say is that I went recently to the Burn Hospital, which is this is just here in Damascus, where they have referrals from all over the country. There are an enormous amount of patients now, so they had to open a new section because burns is affecting the civil population. It is actually the fact that these explosions are taking place and hitting into highly populated areas. And you see a number of children and women with serious burns.
Hoff says the breakdown of water and sanitation is a major concern and is leading to an increase of waterborne diseases. She says hospitals are unable to operate dialysis and other medical machinery because of severe cuts to electricity and fuel. The United Nations sanctions on the Syrian government and its leaders do not include an embargo on humanitarian goods, on medicine, or on medical equipment. Nevertheless, Hoff says the sanctions are seriously affecting the ability of WHO to import medical supplies.
Syria cannot transfer money abroad to procure the medicines that they need. WHO is trying to assist in this, but it is a complicated matter. The Syrian government put $2.5 million available to buy new blood safety tests. We haven't been able as yet to transfer the money to be able to procure on behalf of the Syrian government this important test to make sure that the transfusions can be given free of HIV, free of hepatitis B and C.
Hoff says $100 million worth of medicine is needed in Syria over the next few months. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
VOA invites you to share a glimpse of your life through photography and become eligible to win a new iPad. VOA helps give you insights into the world. Now we want you to share your world with us. Send us your best photos, ones that capture the spirit or the essence of the people and places in your life. VOA judges will choose a winner. For a complete list of contest rules, go to voanews.com/iPad. President Barack Obama will soon make his first visit to Israel as a U.S. leader. He will also go to the West Bank and Jordan for wide-ranging talks that include the situation in Syria and tensions with Iran. VOA senior White House correspondent Dan Robinson reports.
White House Press Secretary Jay Carney confirmed the planned trip during Tuesday's White House news briefing after reporters asked about accounts that first emerged in Israeli media. He said Mr. Obama and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu discussed the visit during a telephone conversation last month.
When the president spoke with Prime Minister Netanyahu on January 28th, they discussed a visit by the president to Israel in the spring. The start of the president's second term and the formation of a new Israeli government offer the opportunity to reaffirm the deep and enduring bonds between the United States and Israel and to discuss the way forward on a broad range of issues of mutual concern, including, of course, Iran and Syria.
Mr. Obama also will visit the West Bank and Jordan to continue what Carney called his close work with the Palestinian Authority and Jordanian officials on bilateral and regional issues of mutual interest. Israeli media reported that Mr. Obama would arrive March 20th. Carney would not confirm that, saying additional information, including dates of travel, will be released at a later time. During his first presidential term, Mr. Obama voiced frustration with his inability to move Israeli-Palestinian peace efforts forward. Efforts were made more difficult by the issue of Israel's settlement policy in East Jerusalem. President Obama and White House officials have frequently described the U.S.-Israel relationship as stronger than ever, but Mr. Obama's relationship with Prime Minister Netanyahu was described as difficult and tense. In the recent Israeli election, Mr. Netanyahu's Likud party emerged as the largest bloc in parliament, but he faces increased political pressure for progress in negotiations for a two-state solution to the long-running Israeli-Palestinian conflict. In 2008, Mr. Obama visited Israel and the West Bank while a candidate for president, pledging to protect Israel and prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons. In September 2010, Mr. Obama brought Prime Minister Netanyahu, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, Jordan's King Abdullah, and then Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak to the White House for talks. At the time, President Obama said he was cautiously hopeful that progress could be made in Israel-Palestinian peace efforts. Dan Robinson, VOA News, the White House.
The Bulgarian government says Hezbollah was responsible for the bombing of a tourist bus near a Black Sea port city last year, in which five Israelis and one Bulgarian were killed. The accusation implicates a group whose political wing is a major force in Lebanon's government. VOA's Al Pessin has details from our bureau in London.
Bulgaria's interior minister, Tsvetan Tsvetanov, made the announcement Tuesday in Sofia. The minister said genetic material led investigators to conclude two Hezbollah operatives were among the three men responsible for the attack, but investigators found no direct link to Hezbollah's backers in Iran or to the Al-Qaeda terrorist network. On July 12th of last year, a bomb exploded on a bus carrying an Israeli youth group at an airport near Burgas. In addition to those killed, 32 Israelis were wounded, most of them children. Another man was also killed, and he was believed to be a suicide bomber. But on Tuesday, the director of the European Union's police agency, Rob Wainwright, told the Associated Press that it may have been a sophisticated, remotely controlled bomb that destroyed the bus. Wainwright also endorsed the Bulgarian conclusion that the attack originated in Lebanon, but said the specific link to Hezbollah is less certain.
From what I've seen of the case, from the very strong links, obvious links to Lebanon, from the modus operandi of the terrorist attack, from other intelligence that we see, I think that's a reasonable assumption. I also have my suspicion, at least, that either Hezbollah itself was responsible for this or it was carried out by people that are closely associated with that group.
Still, the European police official called the Bulgarian finding significant because this would be the first successful Hezbollah attack in Europe in nearly 30 years. The Bulgarian conclusion confirms initial Israeli government charges about the source of the attack. Both Hezbollah and Iran have denied involvement. The United States and the European Union have praised the Bulgarian investigation and denounced Hezbollah for its alleged role in the attack. A White House statement called on European countries to take action to find Hezbollah operational and financial cells on the continent. The EU foreign policy chief, Catherine Ashton, said member countries need to seriously assess the investigation's findings and discuss the appropriate response. The co-founder of MideastNewsWire.com, Nicholas Noe, calls that a very cautious response that does not come close to designating Hezbollah a terrorist organization, a move the United States made in the 1990s and has been urging the EU to do. Noe says there's good reason to be cautious, and the case is at a very early stage, even after the 8-month Bulgarian investigation.
This case appears, or at least is being billed by Hezbollah's opponents, mainly Israel and the U.S., as being a substantial sort of case. So this could be a real game changer for Hezbollah in Europe. The observer of these events needs to be very careful in jumping to conclusions. There is a war going on. There is an information war going on, and there is a military war going on. Do I think it's possible Hezbollah was involved? Absolutely, I think it's possible. But nothing is definitive right now.
Nicholas Noe says a European decision to call Hezbollah a terrorist organization would have a significant impact on the group's ability to operate. And he notes it could also endanger European peacekeeping troops in southern Lebanon. The issue is further complicated because Hezbollah's political wing has a dominant position in Lebanon's fragile government, even though its military wing was blamed for a huge car bombing in Beirut in October that killed the chief of the country's police intelligence unit. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.